This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security. This is the 107th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me Gene Camp. Hi, Gene.
Hello.
L. Gene Camp is a professor in the School of Informatics and Computing at Indiana University. Full disclosure, I advise the School of Informatics and Computing as part of the Dean's Advisory Council. Gene's core interests is technical trust mechanisms in economic and social context. Professor Camp has worked at Sandia National Labs and at Harvard's Kennedy School and has written three books, including Trust and Risk in Internet Commerce and Economics of Identity Theft. She's also published over 70 peer-reviewed articles and holds a BA in math and a BS and an MS in electrical engineering from UNC Charlotte, as well as a PhD in engineering and public policy from Carnegie Mellon University. Gene lives in Bloomington, Indiana, where it is not warm at the moment. It is not warm at the moment, is it?
No, it's hideously freezing.
So you've worked in some nicely diverse places, including Sandia, the Kennedy School, and IU. What do those places have in common?
So what those places have in common is that they're all working on a part of the problem I'm trying to solve. So if you think about computing as trust instead of about we want this to be a Boolean cryptographic assertion of a particular component or attribute, then you start to think about it as probabilistic and not certain. And what I try to do is I try to understand the actual risk underlying it, underlying an action or a choice. And that's what, that's the engineering and, you know, either machine learning or kind of data analysis part that you would think of as computing. And then I try to align the communication that this is an actual risk with the person's mental model of the risk. Because if you want someone to respond to a warning, it needs to align with the stories that they tell themselves. And it needs to align with their understanding of what the risk might be. I mean, if you throw up something that has, you know, 100 words and explains what a certificate is, they don't care. They don't know what a certificate is, and they want this box out of their way. But if you throw something up that says, this is not a bank, that they can understand and make a trust decision. Right? Maybe they want to look at the phishing website, but they won't enter their password, which means that you also have to make the warning actionable. So if you look at that range of places, they cover the same space that my research covers, all the way from, you know, policy, how do we make this work, to the technology, how do we know it's not working, and how do we understand when you're really at risk?
All right, that's a good philosophical answer. How do they have commonalities between, say, this, you know, national lab, this famous political school, and a teaching university? I mean, you teach at
Harvard, there is that. So at the national lab, when I was there, cloud computing was really just starting, and you know, it was so long ago that I don't even think we called it cloud computing. I think we called it the computing plant. I know that's scary, isn't it?
I love it.
So what I was working on then was how do you handle something like that? How do you take the mechanics of trust and allow, for example, code to be distributed across all of these machines?
Right, which probably have different levels of information classification and so on.
And also different levels of reliability. And how do you make sure that if one person gets access to one machine, that they can't then distribute malicious content to the other machines.
Right.
So, and then when I was at the Kennedy School, I did a fair amount of work on how do you build this infrastructure in a way that it can be trusted. I mean, that a fundamental part about privacy is, do we trust this infrastructure?
Right.
How do we know we can trust this infrastructure with our information? So that's a very technical problem, mm-hmm. but it's also a very much an organizational problem and an individual problem.
Mm-hmm. And then IU, along those lines?
Oh, IU has been, I mean, as you can tell from my work history, I'm kind of an octagonal peg in a world of round and square holes, and IU has been an excellent fit for me. I can work with students who are in social informatics and policy, and I can work with students who are very traditionally computer science.
Mm-hmm. So you get a good range of kids interested in different aspects of the problem.
And I have a good team. I have an integrated team across the, not just across the range from studying how teams who are responding, how their interactions affect the efficacy of their response, to a fairly heavy machine learning program, research program, that is allowing us to make clear statements about how trustworthy is a certificate,
mm-hmm.
and how do you align that with user behaviors and warnings.
Cool. So, yeah. Let's start out talking a little bit about usability. So usability is a huge problem in technology, and it's an even bigger problem in security, since especially security configuration is an art all by itself. So what are the main research areas in security and usability, and are we making any progress in usability and security?
Well, it's my research area, so of course we're making progress, Gary.
Glad to hear it, Gene. Tell us all about it.
There's no way we would not be making progress. One of the areas in which we've made a lot of progress on how do you talk to people once you have this infrastructure in place, but I don't think we've made much progress in understanding how far down the infrastructure you need to go.
Hmm.
So because of Silverfish, certificates are kind of current and in the news.
Yes, they are.
So if you look at, it's not just about making warnings that people can understand. It's about making warnings that they care about.
There you go. That's a very nice distinction. I like that.
So suppose you got a new computer and you open it up and you start browsing around. You go to your, I go to IU, right, which is my most trusted provider. But because IU is self-signed, which we have the expertise to do, and let's be honest, a lot of this is taxpayer money, so mm-hmm. it's the right thing to do, I'm going to get a warning for that. So, but if I go to a website and the certificate is signed by a transit company in Turkey, to pick a clear example, I'm not going to get a warning for that.
I love it.
It's true. If it's a rogue certificate,
yeah.
And I'm just going to say, oh, install this software, I'll never get a warning for that.
Right.
So if you look at perspectives, they don't address, self-signed certificates.
Yeah, or your own trust model that you have as a user.
Exactly.
So your work sort of addresses how normal people interact with security. And maybe you can talk about this concept of translucent security a little bit.
Well, there's this idea in usability that everything should be transparent,
mm-hmm.
that there should be a direct response to your action,
mm-hmm.
that, real-world usability, you turn the steering wheel, the car turns. And it turns in the direction that you turn the steering wheel.
I don't know. My kid thinks that's the world's worst interface. He started to drive a car, and he didn't want to do it. And I said, well, what's wrong? He said, this interface is terrible, Dad. I can't believe you people use this thing.
Well, my daughter just finished learning how to drive her new manual transmission car, so I don't think I want her opinion on automatic control.
So. I love it. Anyway, that wasn't your point. Sorry to side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and when you're speeding, you know you're taking a risk. But the idea of traditional HCI is it's completely transparent. Mm-hmm. You move the mouse, and it draws a line.
Mm-hmm.
You type in two numbers, it will add them. But you cannot do that in security because it's inherently about risk.
Hmm.
It's quite probabilistic.
And people have a bad natural conception of risk, according to the latest results.
I think people have a bad natural conceptions of risk, according to the results, starting in, like, the 70s. We understand, we have a lot of understanding offline about how people perceive risk,
mm-hmm.
And what dimensions of risk make something more or less scary or more or less concerning. So although we do want to support the stories people tell themselves, sometimes we want to change those stories a little bit to mm-hmm. make them think, oh, this is more like a disease risk. This is less like a vandalism risk.
So is that what the concept of translucent is about?
Oh, yes. So translucence is about we can't make it completely transparent because we don't know what the results are. But we can't make it completely opaque either because then you just get permission denied.
Right.
So if you think about, you know, Vista, which obviously deserved all the abuse that it got.
I try not to think about that.
I'm sorry. You know, sorry to cause you this psychic pain, but I want you to think about it anyway.
Okay.
I mean, what it did was it said, we're going to make this totally transparent. You're going to know every time you have a risk. We're going to let you know that that's what you're doing. And obviously that is completely overwhelming.
Right.
And nobody knew what risk they were taking. All they knew was that they had to hit that annoying box to get their job done.
Right? I love it. Yeah. So I want to push on this a little bit. In my experience, many users of consumer products in particular have what you might call an implicit expectation of security, but they never really express explicit requirements. As an example, think about how people think of their mobile phones. They think, oh, my mobile phone keeps my conversations private, even though they don't. So their implicit expectation is that they have private conversations, but they never say, boy, I sure hope my conversations are private. That's one of my important requirements. So are implicit expectations like that enough to move the market?
Oh, that is a huge question. I do not think they're enough to move the market because privacy and security are such lemons markets.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And I think security is a mature enough market that we could set some best practices and standards. I mean, there is no way what Silverfish did is, I mean, they managed to violate every best practice you can think of. They even made the certificate cryptographically weak. It was like they had a checklist. What's the worst thing we can do?
Let's make sure we hit everything.
Yeah, let's cover all of them. So we do have best practices that I think it would be quite reasonable for requirements to say, you know, if you are in this industry, these are the practices that you should follow.
Right.
The
issue is, of course, those requirements would not really be derived from the consumers themselves who already think the thing is implicitly secure, even though they shouldn't think that.
Well, I mean, that is true, but we think that in a lot of things where there's this huge background, you know, to get the water that we turn on in the faucet.
Right.
Has a tremendous structure behind it. And so we're used to not having to think about it. Hmm. And as an industry, I think we need to do better. But the two big problems are, it's a lemons market. Anybody can come out and say, this technology is secure.
Right, even though the fact that there is no way to measure that.
Yeah, and when you do measure it, it's not necessarily true. So I have quite a number of undergraduates in my research group. And like I said, some of these are definitely from coming at this from a human-centered social informatics perspective, which, you know, we need. They can do interviews. They can do this qualitative coding. They're great students. But we were talking about Android mobile phone use, and one of them said, well, I don't have to worry about my privacy. I have an iPhone.
Marketing. Isn't that great? Turns out Jobs was right.
And then he said, you know, we don't even have those permissions on an iPhone. Hmm. I said, yes, you do, in fact, have those permissions on an iPhone. And the only study that has compared every Android and every iPhone application that's common has found that in every case, the Apple app had more requirements for permission. That is, the app on the Apple platform was more privacy violating.
Interesting.
And this is an argument for translucence, right? The Android permissions model is fairly incomprehensible to your average user. But even that bit of communication and transparency has had a measurable market impact.
Yeah. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Let's switch gears. Let's talk about another major branch of your work, which we already alluded to, and we're sort of talking about it now, and that's economics and computer security. So what is this field all about, and what kinds of progress have you guys made at the first few workshops?
Well, the basic idea is if you want the market to work, it has to have the components of a working model. That is, you have to be able to say, as a consumer, here's some clear information about my choices, which is clearly aligned with risk communication. Mm-hmm. And like I said about designing trust, you need to design incentives from the bottom up, or it's just not going to work. I mean, I have found in my life that people are generally nice, but very few people are so nice that they'll say, I'll invest immensely in, for example, DNSSEC so that everybody else can have all the advantages, and I'll just hope that maybe one day they'll invest in it too so that I can have some advantages.
Yeah.
I mean, people are nice, but they're incentive aligned.
I think you guys are a little confused about how nice people are there in the Midwest, though.
Oh, yeah, that might be a possible confusion.
Askew.
Yeah.
So,
but I'm right now very happy not to be in Boston.
That's a good point. I have a question that has to do with this economics and security stuff and externalities. So one of the huge challenges that we face in software security is a real issue with not having any externalities. In a sense, measuring security is difficult in software security because all the stuff we do to make software secure while we're building it, only has a shadow of what happens out there in the real world post-release. So you can't look at vulnerabilities found in the wild or zero days or whatever and have a real sense of how secure a piece of software is. So are there answers on the horizon for these things where the externality measurement is just so far removed from all of the engineering that goes in front, or not?
Well, I think what you're saying is your externality is a function of the the emergent use. So, cell phones, we got our first cell phones and they were designed to talk to people and chat. And then we had SMS, which, made people happy worldwide. But now we have banking applications mm-hmm. on phones that were never built for this kind of operation. I mean, we have wallets now on the two major operating systems.
Yep.
And so we end up chasing our own success. But generally that's how advances work. We cannot predict risk. You can't, now we have a good sense of how to predict environmental risk. We know that you don't want this chemical near this chemical. But here, this chemical, we thought asbestos was a fabulous idea. It had so many uses. It was a miracle substance.
Mm-hmm.
So learning about risk over time is something that we've seen in every other domain.
I see. So maybe it's just a function of getting the market to be smarter about what it means to have secure or insecure software.
Yeah, part of it is just the maturity of the industry. I mean, if you look at Apple, they had that serious error where they did not check if you were communicating that the certificate that you were communicating with was the one you were presented at the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this famous go-to fail. And then if you look at Microsoft's announcement, there can be spoofing of certificates announcement, right? Apple has a very different approach. That code was on the internet for anyone to look at
mm-hmm.
for a long time. Whereas Microsoft's code went through, they just destroyed all of this infrastructure for some reason. But at that time, it went through like a trusted computing board, and they had formal code review, and they had, code analysis. So these are kind of the extreme points on software development.
So where do you fall? What do you think we should be doing?
But my point is, neither one of them actually protected us from these failures.
Right. Well, look, software isn't perfect, so software security is an exercise in technical risk management.
Yes, exactly. And I think that what we can do is try to help people choose their own risk. I mean, if you think about risk perception and choices, this is something that, I take the longest time in the grocery store of anybody, because it's this huge real-time information source about how people make risk decisions. And there are some great hysterically funny risk communication out there, in addition to actually useful risk communication. So I saw some GMO-free salt in California.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And I also saw, something else was really funny. The water that had no, natural water. I thought that was great. This water actually had two hydrogens for every oxygen. Right?
All right, let's talk about a little bit about old people and security. So tell us about your work with Kay Connolly and seniors, and whether seniors care about security and privacy.
Seniors do care about security and privacy, and they are one of our most vulnerable populations. Because if you commit identity theft against against one of the undergraduates here, mm-hmm. they have a lifetime to recover. If you commit identity theft against an older person and access their retirement funds, they're in a dire situation.
Mm, very interesting.
And most of our usability research is done on undergraduates who are very comfortable with the computer, who
right.
have grown up with the computer.
So tell us an interesting story about your field research with seniors and thinking about security or privacy.
Well, I learned that you have to have a completely different approach talking about risk to older people.
Uh-huh.
So I teach these undergrads, I have a little survey, and then I give them and I say, what do you do on the internet? You know, just so I know what what people are doing. And then I wait a couple of weeks and teach a little bit about risk. And they say, what risk are you taking on the internet? And if you compare these tend to be fairly, let me just say, they're very optimistic about their risk given their actual activities. You can't do that with older people. It's too scary.
Right.
The goal is not to scare people. And then we built this little toolbar, and the students were walking around with their laptops, and it allowed you to share, you know, to build a group of peers and to share comments nobody else could see about a website.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it provided a lot of feedback. This is not a website you've been to before. Why are you entering a password? But it also allowed for this kind of peer production. We got very good feedback about that. And we showed it to the older population, and they hated it. All the little smiley faces.
Seniors don't like emoticons. You know, you're making me feel like an old man, and it is my birthday today.
Oh, happy birthday. Is it your real birthday or your internet birthday?
It's my real birthday. I'm 49 years old, so I'm getting close to being a senior.
Well, happy birthday. I'll have you know that the people we study as seniors usually start about 68.
That's a relief.
You know. So what we ended up building for older people was literally a cube. Like it looks kind of like the companion cube,
mm-hmm.
but that was not our model, that has up and down arrows. So you could touch the cube, and if you hated a site or really liked a site, mm-hmm. and it would go up or down. But if we thought it was a risky site, it would put up a very simple block image that says, do you want to continue? And then the little cube would be, you know, bright
red
and flashing.
Right.
And they love that. But can you imagine a bunch of students carrying that around, poking out of their backpack?
Yeah, if it had some Pokemon capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a different set of design requirements.
So seniors often fall prey to scams too, I suppose, because, I don't know, dementia begins to set in or the world gets more complicated than you can begin to handle when you're very elderly. So making decisions gets hard, and making security decisions, which is already subtle, is known to be hard for, you know, 20-year-olds. Go.
Yeah, so you have to make it really very simple for them to avoid risk. And we've done some work on what people understand about phishing and certificates, and it is almost nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, people think certificates are amazingly all-powerful, or they just don't know what they are.
Yeah.
One of the answers we got for phishing was basically a lot of people think it's behavioral advertising.
Wow.
They follow you around.
Wow. That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, I could send you the list. It was very eye-opening. So you have to not tell them what phishing is and what certificates are. You have to give them immediately actionable information.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Don't enter your password. It's got to be explicitly action-based.
So let's change gears for one last question. What is your approach to teaching university students about security and privacy? And you've already mentioned the fact that you've got this pretty big range between highly technical kids in computer science versus people that are doing more political studies and informatics. That are, you know, softer science related. What's your approach to teaching these kinds of kids in this range about security and privacy?
So at the younger levels, I go through examples that they very much understand. So let's use this example that's literally about M&Ms or Reese's Cups, right? That about sharing Reese's Cups and pricing Reese's Cups and how much you're willing to invest in this particular Reese's Cup right now.
Mm-hmm.
and then change that to talking about security. If you've already given out your information, as opposed to if you think people are asking for new information, mm-hmm. How is information, you know, not like a Reese's cup? So, for example, once you've eaten that Reese's cup, it is gone, but the information is still out there, even though you still have it. So I use for undergraduates, I use very simple models that leverage their life experience.
Mm-hmm. And you find that those are pretty significantly different from the stuff you use to communicate with seniors.
Well, yes. And for example, one of the things that I know I have impacted is Facebook habits early on in Facebook.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the sharing of information.
The oversharing of information.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
Too much information.
Yeah.
So, yeah, one of the successful ways to do that, incidentally, is if one of your students misses class and posts a picture, you can send them a Facebook message that says, I missed you in class today, but I think it's important that I tell you that Pedialyte is really the best thing for a hangover. Because it's mostly...
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. It's mostly about dehydration.
Gosh, what we learn in Silver Bullet, who knew?
So, yeah.
So last question, and it's a total flyer. What was your favorite music to listen to in 2014?
Oh, in 2014. Mm-hmm. We're just over 2014. So I would have to say it would be Pompeii, because I've listened to it a lot, and the first time I heard it, I thought, this guy thinks he's a singer. That is so fascinating. But now I've gotten to where I really like it, and it's distinctive.
Huh. I'm not even sure what you're talking about. Is that a group?
No, it's an album that came out last year.
Year by the group called Pompeii? Or?
No, Pompeii is the album. I mean, it's kind of pop. Okay, I admit it's totally pop. It's embarrassingly pop, but you know, it's fun.
Great.
And I'm not going to try to sing it.
We'll put a link on the website so people can click on that there.
Okay.
All right, Jean, thanks very much. It's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you so much. Have a good and happy birthday.
Thanks. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, and syndicated by Certa Security. The January-February 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on cryptography. The issue also features our interview with Brian Krebs. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.